introduce.
Dr. Ryan Craig. In fact, can you hold up Ryan's book? It's right behind you on the table. Ryan is assistant prof of sociology at the University of Tampa. And to remind you, that's the one with the funny Russian turrets. Not USF, the great Russian building. He specializes in the sociological study of religion, focusing on Mormonism, the non-religious, that's us. He's actually here to study us, and secularization. He served as an expert legal witness on Mormonism and has presented his research to local and national groups. Today, he's going to speak about his research covered in his book, What You Don't Know About Religion, But Should. And at my request, I asked him to bring along a few copies. For those who would like to buy a hard copy is $20, and it's also available on Kindle. The book introduces social scientific and sociology study of religion for non-experts, using clear and simple statistical analysis, that's what he says, with US and international data. He provides answers to such questions as, what is a religion? Why are people religious? And are the religious more or less moral, humble, happier? And so important, does religion help or hurt society? So Brian will speak about a half an hour, and then we'll do Q&A. And you can run Q&A yourself, or they're all running if you like. Okay, he's a prof. He's a Q&A expert. So please welcome today's speaker, Dr. Ryan Craig.
Okay, so, do I need this, or?
Yes. No.
Yes, no?
Yes, you do.
Better?
Yeah.
Better?
Yeah.
Okay, you're strapping me in here. I like to pace. So,
you have about 20.
Okay. To give you a little bit of background on this, I'm going to start with a story. And I know everybody just ate, so try and hold your lunch down because it's a little bit of a risque story. But I like these stories because it kind of sets up why I'm doing this, right? So to begin the story, and this is going to be a very interactive presentation, that's just my style. How many of you remember these, drive-in theaters? Yeah? Anybody never been to a drive-in theater? Just one? Wow.
Drive-in theater.
All right, drive-in theater. So you drive in, kind of park, watch the movie, right? So I'll try to speak louder. Right, drive-in theater. Okay, how many of you went on a date to a drive-in theater? Now, did any of you actually watch the movie? No. We don't watch movies at drive-in theaters. So I'm from Utah originally. Not surprisingly, I study Mormonism. I used to be Mormon, right? And I'll come back to that. Drive-in theaters are actually still quite popular there. They still have a few that are functioning. It's hard to find anywhere else, right? But they still have a few. When I was growing up, it's not too long ago, this happened in 1995, right? I was a senior in high school. I was 18 years old. I went on a double date, right, with two separate trucks to a drive-in theater. Okay, this is my girlfriend at the time. And basically, so I had a good friend, he brought a date, and he parked his truck, you know, a little bit away, because we wanted our privacy. I parked my truck, and we get in the back, and we had blankets and everything set up, right? So we're going to watch a movie. We're not going to watch a movie. But we're going to watch a movie, right? So we get in the back of the truck, and the movie comes on, and of course, we start making out, right? So I'm making out with my girlfriend at the time, and I'm not going to mention her name. She's now married to somebody else. Good. But we're kind of making out, right? And it starts to get a little hot and heavy, right? It was a little passionate situation here. And it keeps going and progressing and progressing until, and I'm getting very aroused, right? And we're all adults here, so just bear with me. I'm very aroused. After probably 45 minutes of this, I end up ejaculating. In my pants. Okay, because remember, we're Mormons. All clothes are on. Okay? But here's the reason why I tell this story, because I know this is a really weird story, especially after lunch. I had no idea what had just happened to me. At 18 years old, I had no idea. My pants were wet. There's a big splotch there, sticky and gross, but I didn't know what was going on.
But it felt good.
18.
It did. I'm not denying that, right? But I didn't know what had just happened. Why didn't I know what had just happened? Because I grew up Mormon. Okay. Now, of course, plenty of Mormons understand this, right? But understand my particular situation. My parents are very devout members of the religion still today and very conservative. And there were two opportunities when I was growing up, once in 8th grade and once in 10th grade, when I could have had an extracurricular health class where they would teach us about, you know, sex education. But to go to those, you had to have your parents sign a permission slip. And did my parents sign? No. And this is pre-internet days, right? I mean, the internet was just starting. I didn't know any of this. None of this. So I grew up basically ignorant, right, of sex, basic sex. And correct me if I'm wrong, I think we had a pretty clear understanding of what ejaculation was in 1995, right? Yes? I'm guessing most of you can agree. I was taught a lot of things growing up, but there were a bunch of things I was not taught. I was taught that Mormons are better educated than non-Mormons, right? I was taught that Mormons are healthier, largely because they don't smoke and they don't drink alcohol. I was taught that Mormons are nicer than non-Mormons, right? I was taught that they're more generous and they're more likely to volunteer. Okay, so I was taught all of these things. What I was not taught was to accept evolution. I was specifically told that evolution had not occurred, and I was taught a young Earth perspective on creationism. Okay, my parents still think the world is 6,000 years old. Right, so I was taught not to accept evolution. I was not taught about masturbation or that masturbation is normal. Here's a fun statistic for you. Does anybody know what percentage of men masturbate?
97%.
It's 97%, right? So when we get those, the rest are probably liars. But the number is actually 97%. Okay, so that's men. What about women?
Quite a few.
It's about 65%. 65% of women masturbate regularly, right? Those numbers actually come from a guy named Lehman. He's based at the University of Chicago. So he actually did a nationally representative survey and found out the numbers, which is kind of interesting, right? So we do have data on this. I'm a data guy. That's what I do, right? And you're going to see a lot of data up here. So I wasn't taught that masturbation was normal. I didn't know that all my friends were masturbating, right? I wasn't, because I was told that is an egregious sin, the sin of Onan, right? And that you could actually be struck dead by God, if you've read the Old Testament. That's actually what happens in there, right? That he spills the seed on the ground instead of copulate with his brother's wife, right? And is struck dead.
But despite that, you still did it, right?
Huh?
But despite that,
he still did it. He spilled it on the ground, and he was killed. Own and die, right? So I was not taught this. I was not taught that alcohol and coffee in moderation are perfectly fine. All the recent data suggests that is absolutely the case. But I was told, no, it's wrong. Don't do this. And in fact, Mormons believe that by drinking coffee or alcohol, you cannot go to heaven. Really? It is a sin so egregious that it will keep you out of the highest degrees of heaven by drinking alcohol or coffee. Okay, this is how I was taught. This is my upbringing. I was not taught, this is another fun one, that Native Americans are descendants of Asians. Is anybody familiar with Mormonism? Anybody talk to Mormon missionaries? A few, right? Who do Mormons think that the Native Americans descended from? Does anybody know?
Israel.
Who said it? Jews. They're from Israel, right? They think Native Americans are from Israel. There's a whole story, if you read the Book of Mormon, this is where it comes from, right? So that's what I was taught, right? I was taught this. I was not taught that Joseph Smith was caught, this is the founder of Mormonism, having sex with a 14-year-old live-in housemaid, then came up with the idea of polygamy to cover up his philandering. How many wives did he have when he died?
I forget.
33.
Good Lord.
Okay, Brigham Young beat him out. He had 57 when he died. Joseph Smith had 33. And some of them were married to other men. Okay, his youngest, he actually didn't marry this one, right? That was Fanny Alger, that was the first one. His youngest was actually 14. So he did marry a 14-year-old girl, right? I wasn't taught this. Now, I mean, we know these things, right? There's a great book about this, but I wasn't taught these things, right? And of course, I was not taught that if you make out with somebody long enough, you're probably gonna ejaculate. I wasn't taught that either. I wasn't taught any of these things, right? Because I was Mormon. And I was raised in a very rural community in Utah, right, where 89% of my neighbors were also Mormon, right? We knew all the non-Mormons in our neighborhood. We knew them. We literally, I mean, that's how we categorized people, who was in and who was not, right? So that was my upbringing. Now, of course, all of this changes. I ended up deciding, I went on a mission. I was a Mormon missionary, right? Served in Costa Rica from 96 to 98. And as a result of that, I came back thinking, this religion stuff is really important. I've got to figure it out. And so I decided to go to graduate school to study this. But I wanted to do it in a very specific way. I wanted to study it scientifically. So I ended up going to graduate school in sociology to study the sociology of religion, right? I started my graduate work in 2001 at the University of Cincinnati and was, in fact, studying the sociology of religion. About a year of that is all it took, and I was done, right? It didn't take that long. My training was basically teach me to be an empiricist, to think about things scientifically, and after about a year, I turned that new perspective onto my religion and realized, wow, this doesn't hold up. There are significant problems with the religion. And then I left, right? About 6 months later, I started to identify as a secular humanist, like you, right? So that's about what happened. I continued, obviously finished my degree, right? A lot of what ended up happening here, and there's another story, and I do like these stories, so I'll tell you. A lot of what happened, like I said, comes about because of this empiricism, but one particular instance kind of sticks in my head as being very instrumental in getting me to start questioning. Another student who started at the same time I did, his name is Dean, right? I'll use his first name, won't use his last name. He grew up an evangelical Christian, okay? He was originally from Indiana. His parents were evangelical Christians, so they were very devout, and they told him that they would only pay for his college if he went to an evangelical Christian school. So he ended up going to Lee University in Cleveland, Tennessee. I don't know if any of you are familiar with this, but it's an extremely conservative school, right? Because his parents would pay if that was the case. While he was there, right, and this came out in a conversation that we had 3 or 4 months into our first year of graduate school, Dean and I actually became pretty good friends. We're both geeks, right? We're very into tech stuff. We like playing video games, which I don't get to play anymore, but we were kind of geeky, and we got along really well, and it took a few months, but eventually the topic of religion came up, and that's when I found out this story. While he was at Lee University, the Mormon missionary showed up at his door. He's an open guy, he's very inquisitive, he likes to think about these things. So he invited him in, and they started visiting. And I know a number of you said you've already had the Mormon missionaries over, right? Anybody go through all of their discussions, that's what they call them? Three? You made it all the way through, right? Nice, check you out. Good for you, right? It's pretty hard to get all the way through. But so he invited him in, talked, right? And one of the things that they typically do is they'll give you a copy of the Book of Mormon. Did you get a copy of the Book of Mormon? Yes, but they ask you to read it. Good. So they'll ask you to read, particularly, usually there are specific parts, but they want you to read the whole thing, right? It's hard to read the whole thing. Mark Twain called it chloroform in print, which is actually it's true, it actually is. But they'll try and get you to do this, right? And then there's a specific passage, and in that passage it says that how you can determine if the Book of Mormon is true is you read it, and then you pray to God. And God will make you feel whether or not it's true. Okay. So, they did this with Dean. They gave Dean a copy of the Book of Mormon, had him read certain passages, and then they came back, right? Remember, Dean's an evangelical Christian at this point. So he took him seriously. He read it, right? He's a bright guy, right? He's a really bright guy. So he read it. They come back, and they say, okay, did you do what we asked? He said, well, yeah, I read the passages that you wanted. Did you pray? Yeah, I prayed. What did God tell you? And he said, God told me that the Book of Mormon is false and that the Mormon religion is a cult. And that did not go over well with the missionaries, right? But the fascinating thing is he told that to me too. Now remember, I'm a devout believing member at this point, well, largely believing, questioning member at this point. But the crazy thing is Mormons have easy ways to get around that, right? So it's like, oh, well, you didn't ask the right way. You didn't have enough faith, right? Maybe Satan told you that instead of God, right? There are weasel ways around this. But the problem was, I knew Dean at this point, and he and I were good friends. I thought he was sincere. I believed what he was telling me, so I couldn't just dismiss it. And this is one of those first things that just kind of got me down that path to say, yeah, there's a problem here. Turns out, that epistemology, that way of finding out truth, sucks. It's terrible. Feeling things, right? That's not how you learn that something is true. You study it. right? You become scientists. We use scientific methodology. That's why we do that. That's what helped me realize the methodology that I'd been taught my whole life to learn if something was true, like Native Americans being descendants of Jews. That's terrible. You don't pray to God. Do DNA analysis. Turns out they're not. They're Asians, right? It's very easy to figure that out. So this is what got me going down that path, right? Now, the fascinating thing about sociology of religion is some of you have probably heard of this guy, Daniel Dennett, right? Wrote a great book, Breaking the Spell. In that book, this is fascinating. In that book, he basically says religion should not be off limits, right? That there is no aspect of religion. If religion claims that you can pray for people and that they'll heal faster, we should test that scientifically. Guess what? We have. You know what the results are? No, it's a fun study. You guys want to hear a quick study? I do tangents, I'm sorry. So a couple is actually quite a large group of researchers got a bunch of money, about a $6 million grant, right, to study this, to see if intercessory prayer, that's what it's called, when you pray for somebody else, to see if it's effective. So here's what they did. They went to several different hospitals, right, all in the New England area. So this is in New England, several different hospitals. And as people were coming in for heart surgery, they recruited them into the study, right? You have to do this IRB, Institutional Review Board. You have to get their permission. And what they did is they assigned them to one of three groups, okay? So one of the groups, they told them, okay, we're doing this study, right? We are going to kind of include you in the study, right? We are going to, you're obviously going to have the surgery. We're going to pray for you, right? So we're doing the study. We are going to pray for you, okay? Another group, they told them they were going to do the study. They didn't tell them they were going to pray for him, but they prayed for him anyway. Okay, so that makes sense, right? It's like, okay, we'll just double check, right? Now they don't know. And then the third group, they said, we're doing the study. We're not going to pray for you, right? So you're the control group. We're just going to see how you do, right? But you're part of the study. Anybody want to guess who had the worst outcomes?
The ones with the control group.
Wasn't the control group. It was the ones who were told, we're going to pray for you, mm-hmm. right? Why did they have the worst outcome? They actually did. They were more likely to die.
They left it to God, not their own energy.
When somebody says, I'm going to pray for you, it sounds really bad, right? It's like, oh my gosh, I must be in really dire straits. Telling somebody you're going to pray for them actually gives them worse outcomes. $6 million to find out intercessory prayer makes things worse, not better. Right? So, Daniel Dennett said this. We should study every aspect of religion scientifically. Turns out sociologists have been doing this for decades, but they've just been publishing their research in these peer-reviewed journals, right? And some of you are probably familiar with peer-reviewed journals, but we're just kind of hiding things. And part of the reason for that is many of the sociologists of religion are also religious. So when they find out some of the stuff that I'm going to tell you today, they don't really want people to know because it doesn't paint religion in the best light. So they just kind of publish it there and don't tell anybody. My book is geared toward telling you, hey, actually, you know what we know? We know that, and we'll get there, right? So we'll do a few of these. Non-religious people are just as happy as religious people. And you've probably seen this. If you pay close attention to the media, often it'll say things like, atheists aren't happy. Atheists are sad. There was one just a few days ago, right? Like 3 weeks ago, it was a Twitter study. Right? So a bunch of researchers, they looked at tweets. If you're familiar with Twitter, right? It's 140 characters. They looked at tweets by atheists and Christians. And guess who has the happier tweets? Christians. So it turns out they said, atheists are sad again, right? Don't believe in God, it makes you sad. Bullshit. That's not what the data say, right? And we have solid data to back that up now. That's my point, right? So what I'm doing with the book is trying to make these findings accessible to you. The book is back there. We'll talk more about it, right? In the book, basically what I do is I look at international data and U.S. data. Most of it is U.S. data. But in the U.S., I break the religious into three groups, okay? So my first group would be liberal religious people. That'd be like Eugene Robinson, Episcopalians. Unitarians actually get grouped in there, right? So they're the most liberal of the liberal people, but they get grouped in there. So we've got our liberal religious people, right? We've got our moderates, like John Roberts, who's a Catholic, right? Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. So we've got liberal people, liberal religious people, moderate religious people. And again, this doesn't have to do with their politics. This is their religion. And then we have our third group, the fundamentalists, like her, Michelle Bachmann, right? Who is a religious fundamentalist. Now, what do I mean by fundamentalist? fundamentalist has a very specific definition for sociologists. This is people who take their scripture literally. Okay? She believes that Jonah survived in the belly of a big fish for 3 days. She believes that. She believes there was a flood that covered the entire planet. And there was an ark that survived. Okay? Those are fundamentalists. They also tend to exhibit a few other characteristics, but one key one is they engage in black and white thinking, right? There is truth, and there is everything else. And if you don't agree with me, you are going to hell, and you are a bad person. Yeah. Okay? So those are our fundamentalists. I take those three groups, so I break the religious into those three groups, and I compare them to the non-religious, people like Brad Pitt, who's not religious, right? So I compare them on a whole bunch of different questions, and I'm going to show you some that you can look at today. Internationally, I do it slightly differently. The questions aren't the same, and you can't break up religions quite as easily. But I use a slightly different question, which is importance of religion. So they basically asked them, how important is religion to you? And you have these four options: very, rather, not very, and not at all religious. Okay? And I'll distinguish between when I'm doing international and U.S. data. You'll see the flag if it's U.S. data and the globe if it's international data. Okay? So I've got both groups. This is international and U.S.-based data. And these data sets are publicly available, nationally representative data sets. This one, the U.S. one, is NSF funded. It's the General Social Survey. You can download these if you're a stats person if you want to see these. But I'm a stats guy. I like numbers. Okay. Here's what we're going to do today. Right. I guess I don't have tons of time, but we'll see how far we get, and you can stop me at any point.
You have about another 15 minutes.
15 minutes. Watch how fast. You get to choose your topic. So basically, what I've done is I've pulled out 5 chapters from the book, and I've prepared stuff on all of them. You guys can tell me which ones you want me to talk about. We'll take a vote, and whichever gets the most, we'll do that one. Okay? So here are your options. Number 8, all demons are from Hollywood, how media created the possession fad. So we can talk about demonic possession. Number 11, multiply and replenish the pews, why religions encourage procreation. It's a fun one. 15, if you're humble and you know it, you're probably religious. Religion and arrogance. So this is about humility. All right, it's a fun one. 17, love your neighbor, except when he's, which is not how that passage goes in the New Testament, but religion and prejudice. So we can talk about something quite fascinating, right, which is the relationship between religion and prejudice. 24, sleeping on Sunday, religion and health, right? So those are your options. You can choose any one of those, right? And we'll go through those and see how many we can get through. If we get, one or two, that should be plenty, and then we can answer as many questions. And I do go off on tangents. I hope that's okay. So keep me on track if you want. But should we vote?
No, I want to ask you, do you have one that, because we don't know which the hell one to choose. I don't. What do you think would be the most interesting from
most point people, of view? Most people like this one.
That's right.
The prejudice one? Yeah. This is one I do almost every, I've done this presentation like 5 or 6 times. It's usually this one and this one get the big hits. This one's just funny. But we can do those two if you want.
Yeah?
Okay, that's fine. Let's do the religion and prejudice one, and then we'll do the humility one after if we've got time. And do keep in mind, I go off on tangents, so this may go longer than I thought. All right, so prejudice. Prejudice is pretty straightforward, right? This is prejudging people, right? So you have some negative perspective on what people are like. It doesn't necessarily mean discrimination, though I have published research showing that atheists, people who self-identify as atheists, are twice as likely in the U.S. to experience discrimination than people who just say that they're non-religious, right? 40% of atheists report actual acts of discrimination in the last 5 years, 40%, because they say they're atheists, right? So we know this, but that's prejudice, discrimination, that's the distinction. The fascinating thing about this is religions are groups, okay? So if we need a definition of religion, which I do define it in the book, but we'll give a very basic one, religion is basically collective beliefs regarding the supernatural, okay? Now there's a reason why I put collective in there. Why does it have to be collective beliefs, more than one person? If I were to suddenly say that I'm Jesus Christ, what are you going to think? I'm crazy. But if I said I'm Jesus Christ and I have 50,000 followers, what do I have? Now I have a religion. That's the distinction, right? The distinction is really, they can be crazy beliefs. There are some crazy beliefs out there, right? If you can get other people to believe them, you got a religion. That's it. That's the whole distinction,
that's
right?
So religion. L. Ron Hubbard,
absolutely,
for example.
Right? Absolutely. So religions are groups, right? And they have collective beliefs regarding the supernatural. The amazing thing about groups is that they are divisive by nature. When you belong to a group, you like the people in the group just because they're in your group. And people who are not in the group, you don't like as well. That is the very nature of groups. We've shown this, social psychologists have shown this many, many times, right? So we know that groups are divisive. But this gets really interesting, right? We can do a little experiment to kind of help illustrate what's going on here. So this is a little thought experiment. Think for a second of someone who disagrees with you politically, maybe someone like Rush Limbaugh, who said this in 1994. Women should not be allowed on juries where the accused is a rapist, a stud. Okay, so he said that. So if we're thinking about people who don't share our political views, we tend not to like them as well. Now think about somebody who doesn't share your religious views, like, say, Pat Robertson, who's flipping you off in this picture, which you can't see, who said this. I know this is painful for the ladies to hear, but if you get married, you have accepted the headship of a man, your husband. The husband is the head of the wife, and that's the way that it is, period. I don't agree with it either. All right, so we've got somebody who disagrees with you politically, someone who disagrees with you religiously. Now, what about somebody who falls into both of those categories, like Todd Akin, who said this just last year? First of all, from what I understand from doctors, pregnancy from rape is really rare. If it's a legitimate rape, the female body has ways to try to shut that whole thing down.
Yeah, well,
religious and political conservative. How do we tend to think about people like this? Okay. We tend not to like them, right? We don't like these people. They're in the other category, right? So we have a whole bunch of words that come to mind. The fascinating thing is we understand exactly why this happens, right? So what's going on? If we put you in the middle, and yes, that's an androgynous you, so I've got both men and women there. If we put you in the middle, right? People who share your political views, that would be this group. People who share your religious views, that are non-religious, as the case may be, would be this group, right? And then, of course, we have all of the assholes who don't share either of your views. You don't like those people, right? They're not fans. You don't like them, right? The people you like the most are the people who are the most like you. Okay? And it starts to sound really kind of almost prejudiced in another sense, right? That it's like, well, yeah, I like to hang out with people who are just like me. Well, I hate to say it, look around the room, right? This is a very homogeneous group. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. There's nothing bad about that. That's who we tend to like. Why? Right? How many people really love to spend time with people who just disagree with them all the time? Right? It gets really old after a day, right? I go and visit my family. I love my family. Still in Utah, I have 8 siblings, right? Big family. None of them agree with me. So I love to visit. I would hate to live next to them, right? Because, you know, a couple days is pretty good, but after that, I run out of stuff to say that's politically neutral, right? Because I just can't spend time with people who disagree with me for that long, right? So this is basically what's happening with religion as well. The fascinating thing about this is that the non-religious people in the U.S. are the least likely to hate those in their out-group. Okay? This is fun. Here come the data, right? For those who like data, and I don't know if you like data, but here come the data. We're going to look at data, okay? So what do we have? Here's the first one. This is U.S.-based, so this is in the U.S., and again, I'll break this down so you can see what's going on. This one will not be that surprising. The next two will get a little bit more surprising. So what we have up here, this is the percentage of people who oppose or strongly oppose two specific issues. This first one, oppose homosexual marriage in the U.S. Okay? And what we have in these different groups, here are our fundamentalists in blue, our moderates in red, our liberals in yellow, and the non-religious in green. So as far as opposition to homosexual marriage in the U.S., who's most likely to oppose this? Fundamentalists. Okay, that's not surprising. We get that. No one's going to be surprised by that. We're going to keep going, though, right? Okay, least likely to oppose this, 20%, which is still 1 in 5. That's a lot, right? But of the non-religious, they're the most accepting of this, right? It's absolutely the case. Okay, So slightly different question. This is homosexual marriage, right? This is the percentage who think homosexual sex is always wrong. Always wrong, okay? Now, there are other options there. I'm only reporting the percentage who say it's always wrong. There's also sometimes wrong or not wrong at all, okay? Those are the only two options, other two options. This is 70% of religious fundamentalists in the U.S. say homosexual sex is always wrong. Okay, and this is not ancient data. This is 2010 data. It's 3 years old. Okay, and the most recent version of this survey, which didn't come out until after I finished the book, exact same numbers. This hasn't changed much, right? Yeah, question.
I'm actually surprised the fundamentalist view is that low, yeah. And the atheist view is that high.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So again, I've got to be very careful in how I show data, right? If you look at the other 30% for fundamentalists, almost all of them say it's usually wrong, right? So almost no fundamentalists are like, oh yeah, homosexual sex is fine, right? But if you look here, so even of this, right, it's 19%, that's pretty high. Most of them are saying, actually, it's perfectly fine, right? So there's still split views, but we've got data on this to back this up. Okay, that's not surprising. We know this is a big issue. This is a current issue.
You have about 10 minutes more for the rest of the group, and then we do Q&A.
Oh, well, we can do Q&A anytime, too. So feel free to ask questions, but that's great. Keep me apprised.
Because I would like you to get the other slide.
Sure.
We wanted to hear about arrogance.
Oh, we'll do the arrogance. We'll do the arrogance, too. We can do that. It's fine. All right, next one, okay? This is the percentage of people who would not allow certain people to talk in their community. So the way the question is asked is, would you allow so-and-so, right? So somebody with this characteristic to speak in your community. Some of these are not going to be surprising. Some are going to be a little bit surprising. The first one, percentage who would not allow an atheist to speak. So you can't even speak. I would not be allowed, according to these people, to speak publicly in the local community. Fundamentalists, it's 38%. Strangely, among the non-religious, which not all non-religious people are atheists, so we've got that clear, right? It's 10%.
Wow.
Okay? So the 40%, almost 40% of fundamentalists are like, they shouldn't even have a voice in public. They also ask about being able to teach college. Numbers are very similar. So that's atheist. Okay? Next one, not allow a communist to speak. Bumps up to 50%. Okay? So they wouldn't allow a communist to speak, period. Down here it's 20%, right? 19-20%. Percent who would not allow a homosexual to speak publicly. That is 1 in 4 fundamentalists in the US say no. They shouldn't have a public voice. We should not allow them to speak. And here's one that's gonna throw you a little bit for a loop, right? This is the percentage who would not allow a racist to speak. Now why is this a little bit weird? Okay, so we've got 48%, almost 50% of religious fundamentalists say no. Racists shouldn't be allowed to speak. That almost sounds like a good thing, right? 31% of the non-religious say no, they shouldn't. But the non-religious are actually still the most accepting of a racist speaking. Why? Someone answer this for me.
Freedom of speech.
Freedom of speech. We value freedom of speech. We don't care what your ideas are. They may be ridiculous. We may completely disagree with you, which I'm about to show you they do, right? But we still want you to have a right to speak. You still get to speak. We don't care if you're crazy. You get to speak, right? So we've got good data on this. Here's my last one on prejudice, right? So what's going on? So this is the percentage of whites. This is just whites, right? So I had to limit this down because it's a very specific question. Who would oppose or strongly oppose a close relative marrying a black person? This is 2010 data. 50% of religious fundamentalists say no. Still 22% of the non-religious. Still disturbing, right? 50%, okay? So who are the most racist?
Fundamentalists.
Big shocker, right? And what about this? This is the percentage who oppose or strongly oppose a close relative marrying a Jew. 22% of religious fundamentalists in the U.S. say, no, can't marry a Jew, right? This is prejudice. It's flat out prejudice. There's no other way to paint this, right? And what do we see? Prejudice is tied to religion. Why? Not surprising. What is religion? Religion is a group. If you're in, you're in. We like you. If you're out, we don't like you. Right? And we've actually seen this. It's a great book. Divided by Faith talks exclusively about this. White evangelicals, that's who they look at in the book. White evangelicals are the most likely to blame blacks for being poor. They say they're lazy. They don't work hard enough. And that was actually written by two evangelical Christians because they can't deny the data. The data support that. Yeah.
But isn't the yellow mark shocking? That's the
one that pops up.
The liberal religionists.
It's a little weird, right? But there's you want the technical explanation here?
All right.
Is that okay? A little technical. Statistically, if you begin to control for things like income and education, this starts to drop out. What's going on? Liberal religious people in the U.S. are actually the most affluent of any group, right? So they're quite wealthy, and when you control for that, that starts to disappear on that one. So basically, rich people don't want their kids marrying someone they perceive to be poor. Does that make sense? So it gets a little bit more technical. I didn't do any of those controls in here because it's just too technical. So,
are these other all questions? In your book?
Yeah, all of these are in the book. There are dozens of them.
I'm going to save me that book back there.
There are like 50 of these.
Most of those, that's good solid stuff.
Because we have the data. That's my point. We have this data. We've had it for decades. We just haven't been sharing it with anybody. I'm
disappointed in the damn atheist thing.
Yeah, isn't that terrible? It's still pretty bad. Still pretty bad. Okay, so what's going on, right? Surprise, surprise, Christian fundamentalists in the U.S. are more likely to dislike, hate's probably the wrong word, but dislike, blacks, Jews, homosexuals, atheists, and communists, right? All those people. And just to throw this in, Pete Seeger does identify as a communist. Just to throw this in, because it is kind of interesting, they're also the most likely to beat their wives and their kids.
That doesn't surprise me.
It's not that surprising, but again, we have data to back that up. That's the amazing thing. We know this. We just need to make everybody aware of this.
Excuse me, are those fundamentalists all religions? The most religious of all religions?
Right. It's a great question. So it gets a little bit tricky. Remember my definition, it's literalists, right? The term fundamentalist originally was used just for a very specific group of Protestants. So after Darwin wrote his book on the origin of species in 1859, there was a big division that began to develop among Protestants in the U.S. between the liberals, who actually said, science, we're okay with that. We're going to accept it, right? Moderates accept some of it, not all of it. The fundamentalists said, no, we are not going to accept these advances. Anything that contradicts our literalistic interpretation of scripture, it's out, right? So that split, actually, it comes about, the term fundamentalist comes from a set of pamphlets that were written by group members of this group who said, no, we're not going to accept it, called the fundamentalists. And so the term fundamentalist was actually originally applied to this specific subset of Protestants in the U.S., but today, we've broadened that to basically any religious group. So we have fundamentalist Muslims, we have fundamentalist Buddhists, fundamentalist Hindus, and of course, fundamentalist Christians, right? Any member of any religious group that exhibits those types of characteristics, they interpret their scripture literally, or they engage in black and white thinking, us versus them, there's the truth and there's everything else, they're fundamentalists.
Aren't there fundamentalist Jews too?
Yes. There are fundamentalist Jews as well.
And that's included in.
Yes. So, anybody know what percentage of Christians in the U.S. are fundamentalists? It's a fun question. Too many is true, but 30. It's about 33%. 33% of the U.S. population still says, go ahead and argue.
You mean 33% of Christians?
Christians.
33% of Christians, I think.
I think I did say Christians. It's actually slightly higher. It's 33% of the entire population. It's slightly higher. It's about 40% of Christians. Yeah.
Really?
You're saying we have 100 million Christians fundamentalists?
Mm-hmm. Yes. That's what I'm saying. Yeah. Yeah. It's disturbing. That's why I'm writing the book. It's incredibly disturbing. Yeah.
Where do the Catholics fall?
They're moderates. They get grouped into the moderate group here.
There's some Catholics.
Oh, yeah. And that's a tricky part. I mean, regardless of how, and this gets really tricky, when you start classifying religions, right? Within any religion, there's going to be a lot of diversity, right? So you have plenty of Catholics today who are actually fully accepting of science. They're fine with that, right? Another fun tidbit, right? What percentage of Catholics in the U.S. use birth control?
90%, I would say.
It's 65%, right? But they're not supposed to. That's precisely the point, right? What percentage of Catholics think that priests should be allowed to get married?
A lot.
It's about 65%, right? So they disagree with their religion on very big issues, but they're still Catholic, right? So there's diversity within the religions, and that gets a little bit tricky. But at the end of the day, you kind of have to just group stuff together to come out with a picture.
You know, so, based on the schedule for... You might want to sum up.
Oh, that's it. I think I'm done.
And we're ostensibly.
What time are we supposed to be out? Oh, like we're out of here. Out of here at 1:30.
Somebody just, if there's any one big point and you wish to be sure to make to us, and then maybe.
Megs, can't we stay longer?
Yeah, I just know some people do have to leave. Well, then okay, so if you have a
system. We'll do one more.
Okay, so if somebody has to leave, don't feel sorry.
Yeah, I won't feel bad.
Because we're all partial.
Yeah.
Okay, so we have this other one.
And also the hotel needs to go. So why don't we take another 10 minutes?
10 minutes, is that okay?
Yeah.
Sure. I'll go fast.
More.
Okay, here we go.
I'm going to buy your book, by
the
way. All right. So, this next one, this again, this is a chapter in the book, so you can read it if you want. All these others are in there, too. Arrogance. These questions for you. How many of you have been called arrogant or proud for being non-believers? Has anybody had this happen to you? Just three, right? Or have been told that your arrogance is what keeps you from believing in God?
Yeah, I think
got a few more here. It's a fun one. So this is actually pretty common among various religious groups. They will use this, right? So I got another story for you. It's a good friend of mine, amazingly. I get together with a couple of buddies, right? This is Tom. I actually was just together with him a month ago. High school buddies. So they grew up in that small town that I grew up in. Both of them are still Mormon. Okay. We get together once a year because we were really good friends. We're still trying to keep that friendship together. And what we do is we go hiking. Okay. So we go and we climb a mountain basically once a year. That's kind of the idea. It keeps us, you know, active, and we kind of renew our friendship. One of those hikes, this is the highest point in Texas, called Guadalupe Peak. It's out in West Texas. We're hiking along. My other buddy, so he's not, this is Tom, this is me right here. The other buddy took the picture, but he doesn't really like talking about religion, right? He gets really testy about it. So whenever Tom, who likes talking about it, Tom and I start talking about it, the other buddy kind of just disappears, right? He'll hike slower and get way behind us. One of our hikes, we're climbing. We get up, it's like 3/4 of the way up the mountain, and we start talking about religion. And in this conversation, Tom, you know, and I don't remember what we were talking about, but Tom actually says to me, he says, Ryan, I know why you left the Mormon Church. And I'm like, oh, do tell. Why did I leave the Mormon Church? And he said, as soon as you got your PhD, you thought you knew more than the leaders of the religion. It's your arrogance that keeps you out of the religion. Now, the irony here is, I probably do know more than the leaders of the religion. Right? I mean, that's the truth. Right? But the claim is a beautiful claim. Right? They're claiming that we're the arrogant ones. They're using this as a weapon, right, to attack us. But it turns out that's not what the data say, right? Arrogance is actually a really tricky concept. From a purely psychological standpoint, having pride and self-confidence in yourself is a good thing. There's actually nothing wrong with this. In fact, most psychologists will tell you, you should have self-confidence. You should take pride in your accomplishments, right? I have a 4-year-old son. I tell him all the time, I'm so proud of you, right? I love that you did this. It could be the worst drawing ever, but I'm still going to tell him that it's great, right? I'm building up his self-confidence. So pride in and of itself isn't a bad thing, but really what they're talking about is conceit, right? This is overbearing pride, evidenced by saying, I'm better than you. So that's what they're claiming we have, right? They're saying, oh, you think you're better than us, and that's why you've left. That you can't believe, right? Not exactly, right? So religious people are going to claim that pride is bad, and then they're going to accuse the non-religious of being proud, and they also will claim that humility is good. And you can read this. There are a bunch of passages in the New Testament, the Old Testament, that talk about pride goeth before the fall, right? The arrogant, the arrogant fool, right? So they talk about all these things. But that's not exactly how this works, because this is actually a form of doublespeak for those who are familiar with George Orwell's 1984, right? What's going on? Religious people are far more likely to claim to know things that they can't know. When they say, I know there is a God, really? Where's your evidence? No, seriously, where's your evidence, right? I'm not saying that there isn't, but can you know that definitively? I'm sorry, you can't, right? You can't prove it to me, but religious people are very commonly found saying, I know this is true. I know God speaks to me. Really? What did he say? Can he speak to me the same way? They're claiming to know things they cannot know, and they certainly don't know. And on top of that, they are so confident that they're right, what do? They try and convince you that they know what God wants you to do. That sounds kind of arrogant to me. Just saying. Sounds a little arrogant, right? Amazingly, non-religious people are the least likely to assert things when they don't know. They're the most likely to say, I don't know. Is saying I don't know arrogant? It's the exact opposite. It's admitting you don't have the answers. It is humility writ large. Non-religious people are the most likely to say they just don't know, right? So claiming to know things when you don't, and claiming you're right when you can't know what is right, according to religious people, is humility. Is anybody else scratching their head? I'm sure scratching my head, because it doesn't make any sense. But that's precisely what they're doing. Yeah.
Can I ask, I just wonder, are people who are a little mentally disturbed, religion aside, people suffering from anger, alcoholism, you know, something, is that community also more likely to insist they know when they don't?
I don't actually have good data on the mentally disturbed. Here's a fun one for you. There are no atheists in prison. So you've heard probably there are no atheists in Foxhole. That's bullshit. There are lots of them. There are no atheists in prison, though. That's a fun one. And we actually have data to back that up. Atheists are substantially underrepresented in prison populations. So I don't know about mental health, right? But so that's kind of a different question. But we actually have that data.
I'll just add something to what you said. Sure. Remember, we're talking about 85% of the people. Yeah, they're all deranged with some cells in their head, but 85% of the people are religious. Remember that. Not fanatic.
It's now 80%, so it's gone down. It's no, 20%
I know, but I think it's, well,
yeah.
85% believe in God.
Nope, even that one's lower.
Is that in your book?
That's in my book, too.
Because I've read some of this data myself, I remember it's about...
Check the book.
More people believe in God than believe in religion.
Well, that's actually, that's actually an interesting point, because you probably interviewed a lot of people who are doing
studies.
Can you
be loud? Be louder so people can hear.
The point is, when you ask people, do you believe in God, a lot of them say yes out of convenience. In other words, social acceptance
probably
is very important here.
Well, okay, so
it might actually be lower than that.
So, okay, can we do a quick tangent? Is that okay? And then the data are next, so I'm going to show you data on this. But quick tangent. So here's a fun one, right? Today in the U.S., about 80% of people say that they're religious. They've got a religious affiliation. When we ask the question, what is your religion, if any, about 80% give us a religion. It's about 20% who say they're non-religious. Now, not all of those people are atheists. But here's the tangent that I want to go on, which is kind of fun.
Point.
What percentage of people in the U.S. go to church?
45?
So here's the fun one. This is
not
fun. When you ask in a survey, right, how often do you attend religious services? It's about 40% who say they go weekly. Okay, it's about 40%. But here's the fun part. Are they actually going? No. Some enterprising sociologists said, hold on, those numbers don't add up. If 40% of Americans were actually going to church, we'd need double the number of churches we have. So what did they do? They went to two local, small communities, one in Ohio, one in Georgia. Smaller communities because they wanted to be able to go to every single church on Sunday. So what do? They give their survey a couple of weeks ahead of time, and they get that 40% response. 40% say they're going to church. Okay. Then the next Sunday, what do? They go in, and they don't take attendance in all of them. Some of them, they say, okay, priest, pastor, tell us how many were here. And those that were the priest or pastor wouldn't tell them, they stood out in the parking lots and they counted. Now, what percentage of Americans are actually going to church on any given Sunday or Saturday?
20%.
It's half.
That's the best news I've heard in years.
Isn't that great? Right? 1 in 5 Americans is in church on Sunday. 1 in 5. We are not a particularly religious country. Just keep that in mind.
Politically, they act like they're religious.
Oh, they do, right? Yeah. But that's just to get elected. That's to do all sorts of things. We're not a particularly religious country. There are more people shopping in a Busch Gardens because that's where I am on Sunday mornings, right? There are more people there than in church.
At the beaches.
Well, obviously, half.
In general,
when we do know a lot of people. And that's actually due to what we call response bias. So in the U.S., there is this perceived notion that being religious is good. And we're trying to change that. There's a reason why that exists, right? It probably has to do with the Cold War. I'll get your question in just 1 second. What happened during the Cold War, right? What did we affiliate communism with? Godless communism. We associated atheism with communism. That made it very bad, right? So for a long time, if you said I'm not religious, you were at risk of being accused of being a communist. But what happened in 1989? Communism collapses, and in 1990, 7% of the population was non-religious. 1990 was 7%. By 2001, it was 14%. It had doubled. And since 2001, 600,000 people a year stop identifying as being religious. 600,000! Because now you're not accused of being a communist. They weren't religious before. Now they just don't have to admit it. We had a question.
When we've been in Europe several times in the last few years, religion is in steep decline through most of that continent.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe worse in France than any place else, where one guy told us there are more of you, meaning tourists, in these cathedrals than there are parishioners.
I haven't done this everywhere. I do actually, I go to church about twice a year, so you guys don't have to, right? It's true. I go to study them, right? It's kind of like a biologist going to the zoo. Which sounds terrible, but it's true. So, it's bad. But that is why I go, right? And I go to churches all over the place, lots of different churches. I've been to churches in England, because does anybody know what percent report going to church on any given Sunday in England? 5%, right? So one of the churches I went to, old, beautiful Anglican church, not far from my hotel, right? I found it, and I was just like, I'm going to go because I've heard the numbers are so low. I just want to see what's going on. Beautiful church, right? Old brick building, probably several hundred years old. And I walked in, right, a little bit late. They hadn't quite started, but they were getting ready to start, right? And as I walk in, there's kind of like a foyer area at the very back of the church, right? There's a foyer area and glass. So I can see all the way up to where the altar would be, right? And this church is amazing, right? It's got balconies on both sides, and then it's got, you know, a full space here. Easily could have sat 300 to 500 people, okay? What they had done, this is amazing. Anybody want to guess how many people were there?
12. 15.
Okay. They had taken the altar that was all the way in the front, and they'd moved it all the way to the back. They'd installed 2 massive screen, like flat panel TVs, on either side of the balcony, and then they put a semicircle of chairs right at the very back, so it didn't feel like it was empty. And when I walked in, I happened to be with my brother-in-law, who was doing a postdoc in Paris at the time. When I walked in, they saw 2 young men. You would have thought, right, that the Prince of Wales had just walked in. I was like, please, come, sit down, right here, we love you. And then I spoke, and they heard an American accent, and they were like, oh, they're not coming back, right? They're empty. Their churches are empty. And there's a complicated reason for that. Anyway, okay, sorry, I know we're way too many tangents. Okay, the data. So here we go.
Oh. No, about 4 minutes.
4 minutes, okay. Real quick question. Yes.
Well, I'm wondering about the religion of the immigrants, like the Muslims.
Let me go check. I'm going to go check to make sure that they don't...
You mean in the U.S.? Immigrants in the U.S. or immigrants in Europe?
Oh, all over.
immigrants, it's pretty interesting. Immigrants tend to retain the religiosity that first generation. So the first immigrants, right, they tend to maintain it. By the second generation, they have acculturated to the current religiosity of the population for most of them. It depends. It gets a little bit tricky. France is a good instance of this. So in France, where they have immigrant enclaves, right, so basically you have a whole bunch of immigrants come in and then they kind of take over a community, right, then their religiosity tends to continue, right? But if they're living next to everybody else, guess what? The kids of the immigrants, they look just like the kids who have been there for hundreds of years. So immigration, yes, immigrants do increase the level of religiosity in the U.S., right?
Before they throw us out, would you
go? Okay, we'll do the data. Is that okay?
Yes.
Come back. Okay, so let's do data. All right, this is international data. I didn't find comparable data in the U.S., but this international data comes from the World Value Survey. So this is looking at people who say, how important is your religion? Blue is very, so it's the same kind of order. Very important, rather, not very, and not at all. Not at all is the green. And here are the questions. I love these questions.
Can I interject? Yeah. I heard a comma in that, so I'm squeezing my comma. Pelican Point says, take your time.
So
my message to everyone, so I'm thrilled. This is so interesting. But I do invite anyone that has another appointment, go ahead, don't be self-conscious. And as I said, the washrooms are right outside. So don't stand on ceremony.
Okay.
And thank you so much. And
sure.
It's, I think, 25 to, why don't we go until like 2 o'clock?
Well,
whatever.
Think organic. Okay. So, my questions here. What we have is a series of questions where they basically ask, does this kind of describe you, right? And then they give them a series of statements, and this is the percentage who say, yes, this is me, right? So here's the first one. I enjoy convincing others of my opinion.
Yeah.
Okay, and who's most likely to say yes?
The most
religious. Those who say they're the most religious, right? Now, the least religious pop up a little bit on that one. It's kind of interesting, right? The most religious say yes. Next one. I serve as a model for others. That's interesting. A little bit higher up there, right? I own many things others envy me for. There's that whole 10th commandment thing there that's a little weird, right? But whatever. Same numbers.
Okay.
Ooh, somebody knows some stats. These, probably not. All the others are.
Yeah.
Right? I ran those, but I didn't include them because most people don't know what that is. So, I like to assume responsibility. And here's the coup de grace. I often give others advice. 57% of those who say religion is very important to me say, yeah, I often give others advice. Who's the most arrogant? Is there any question in your mind who's the most arrogant at this point? No, it's exact opposite, right? So who is more arrogant? Turns out, the more religious people are, the more likely they are to be arrogant. They think others look up to them, others envy them, they like to assume responsibility, and they think other people want their advice. And we know this. The data support this. It's right there, right? Plus, on top of that, they claim to know stuff that they can't know, and they claim to be right. That sounds pretty arrogant to me. Now, not surprisingly, all they're really doing is taking after their God. How is their God described, at least for the monotheists, right? Their God is a jealous, supreme, superior, all-knowing, all-powerful, and perfect God. If you met anybody who self-describe themselves as having any of those characteristics, wouldn't you call them arrogant? Yeah. Arrogant people worship arrogant gods. It's true. All right, so I think we're done on the arrogance one. Questions?
I have a question for you. Is
sure.
it tricky for you to be a professor and have such a definitive point of view about this? Do you understand my question?
Yeah, sure. I don't present this way in my classes. Let's just put it that way. Now, I only teach one class that is the sociology of religion. And the amazing thing about that is I actually don't talk a whole lot about atheism in that class. In fact, I start out the class by telling them, I'm not going to tell you what my religious views or non-religious views are, right? And I, it's kind of sad, right? But I consider my class a success. The very end, I tell them, I'll tell you after the final is in, right? But usually on the final, I'll ask them, bonus question, write down what you think my religion is, right? Invariably, I come out as a liberal Christian. And I consider that a success because I'm trying to be as objective as possible, right? So when I present, and it's not this data, this is my book, right? But when I'm presenting in my classes on religion, I do love just undermining students' religious belief. I hate to say that. I do, right? But I try and do it completely objectively because the numbers are the numbers, right? One of my favorite ones, this is one that I love to do in my classes, is to talk about the evolution of God, right? There's a great book by Karen Armstrong called The History of God, right? And if you haven't read it, I strongly recommend it. She talks about how the God of the Old Testament starts out as a polytheistic God. Right, and you can read this, Genesis 1:26. What does it say? Right, and God created us. And God created man in. Let us create man in our image. That's what it is. Let us create man in our image. Who is God talking about? Who's our?
The royal R. He was.
That's what you were taught in Sunday school. That's not what it was. Right. That was a polytheistic God saying, there are lots of gods. Let's create man to mirror us, right? And here's another one. So it continues. You can see the evolution of God from a polytheistic deity in the Old Testament to by Exodus, right? We have the very first commandment. What is, anybody know first commandment? What is it?
I am the Lord thy God, and thou shalt not have any other gods.
No other gods before me. Now today, most Christians will interpret that as what, right? What are those other gods? You can't worship money or cars. No, what was the scripture actually talking about?
Other gods.
Not sure.
Other gods existed in the Old Testament. So what we see is Genesis, it's lots of gods, right? So it's actually in our image is talking about lots of gods. By Exodus, we now have from polytheism to henotheism. He's the chief god, worship him, but the other gods still exist. It's not that there aren't other gods, and in fact, we see that throughout the Old Testament. We finally get to Kings, right, where Elijah has the best pissing match ever, right, with the priests of Baal. What does he do? If you're not familiar with the story, it's a great one, right? So the children of Israel have kind of lost their way. They're not following Elohim anymore. So Elijah comes into town, right, and he says, look, we're going to have a competition. You bring the priests of Baal, and I'm going to show up, and we're going to see who can call down fire from their gods. This is actually what happened. This is, you know, it doesn't happen, but this is what is said to have happened, right? So what happens? Well, Elijah's like, I'm so confident in my God, I'm arrogant. You guys go first. So the priests of Baal, they take their bowl, right? So they get a bowl, they cut it up, they put it on the altar for Baal, and then they start praying to Baal, and they're screaming, and they're yelling all day long, and they're cutting themselves. They're trying to get Baal to do anything to burn up their offering, and nothing happens. So they do this all day long. And then what does Elijah do? He's like, all right, you had your chance. It's my turn, right? So he goes up very carefully. He rebuilds the altar to Elohim, to Jehovah, right? He rebuilds the altar. He cuts up his bowl. The epitome of arrogance, right? And he says, okay, I've got my bowl up here, but I'm not done. He digs a trench all the way around the altar, and he sends some servants and says, go get water from the river and pour it on top of my bowl because that's how confident I am in my God. So they do. They bring up the water and they pour it onto the bowl, right? And then he says, well, that's not good enough. Go get it again. So they go get more water and they bring it up. And they start to fill up this trench. And then he sends them a third time. So three huge groups of water on the bowl. And then he says a very subtle prayer. Jehovah, I know you're there. Send down your fire. Boom! Fire rains down from heaven, burns up the bowl, burns up all the water, destroys the altar. It's so powerful. And then what does Elijah say? Your God doesn't exist. Mine does. See those priests? Go kill them. And they take all 400 priests of Baal to the valley next door and they slaughter them. And what have we just seen? We've seen the evolution of God from a polytheistic God in Genesis to a henotheistic God in Exodus to the only God in Kings. And that's a story that I tell my students all the time. And you should see their brains explode when I tell them that story. Because they're like, no, I was taught in Sunday school that it's just one God. Really? Have you read the Old Testament? Because the Old Testament doesn't say that. The Old Testament talks about lots of other gods. Got a couple questions, yeah.
But why, I'm going to be arrogant enough to make a correction.
Oh, please do.
The Old Testament.
Please do, sure.
The word Elohim was taken by
God.
Christians to be synonymous with Yahweh.
Right.
But it's actually, in Hebrew, a plural word.
It
means the gods.
Yes, it's the chief god. El is the chief of the gods. So Elohim is the chief of the gods.
I am is a plural.
Yeah, so it's the chief of the gods is what Elohim is. So, yes.
I don't understand the point of the chief of those, of your going from multiple gods to so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Using the Bible as a legitimate text, as a factual text, my understanding is that who the heck wrote it?
Oh, sure, sure.
It's an amalgam of stories, of myths that
Absolutely.
Have been brought down from thousands of years of sitting around the fire and grunting.
Right.
And how is it a legitimate reference?
No. Great point. The reason why I use that, right? One, there's pretty good historical scholarship to support the evolution of the belief in God, right? That's what Karen Armstrong did as a historian and archaeologist. But the reason why I use it is because the students accept it, right? So I'm basically using something that they already accept and saying, look, I don't even have to come out with like some other book from some anthropologist.
Yeah.
It's your book.
Yeah.
And your book is the one that is saying God evolved.
But,
does that make sense? So I'm using their book.
So you're bringing out something with which they're already familiar.
Bingo.
That they consider sacred or
and just showing them, you're not actually reading the book the right way because it's right there, right?
But how do you help? Do you bring out the point that this is just a bunch of nonsense to begin with?
Okay, I don't use the word nonsense. That would be a little bit too much,
yes.
Right? But, of course, when, you know, students will say, right, another fun one is I'll tell them, how did the Bible come into existence?
Okay.
Right? So I'm certainly undermining it in different levels, right, by saying, well, how did the Bible come into existence? People voted on it. What? What? You mean people voted on which books to accept?
Right.
Yeah, that's how it came into existence. That really bugs them, right? And again, it's not that I'm really trying to attack their religious beliefs. This is just true. Right? If it has that effect, okay. Okay, we've got a question here, and the one.
How receptive has the media been to you and your book? I'm talking talk shows, acceptance, or resistance, or what?
It's hard to actually get on a lot of these big shows, right? So everybody who's read it has really liked it, right? I've got great reviews on Amazon.
Well,
so
I'm book signings locally. So.
I've done a few, right? Every presentation that I've given, people have loved it, right? People really like the book, people have said that. But as far as, and even critics, right? People who may not agree with me have said that it's well written, it goes fine. The problem is, really, you have to spend a lot of money to get on kind of a national stage, right? You have to get a publicist. I'm not gonna get a publicist, sorry. I hate to say it, right, but I've got a perfectly fine job. I'm not writing this for the money. I'm really not in it for the money, right? I make enough to be perfectly happy as a college professor. I just thought this was useful information. I don't know, is it useful information?
Yes.
I like this, right?
Yeah.
That's why
I like the statistics, that's really what's good.
That's what's missing in the community of people
really
who are reading.
Good.
So we've got a question here, and then we'll work our way back that way. If that's
you're at, is it University of Kansas?
Yeah, University of Kansas.
Have you met any resistance from the administration and or the parents in the things that you've talked about?
Right. The administration largely ignores me because I publish a lot, right? And they don't get to determine tenure. My colleagues get to determine tenure. Most of my colleagues agree with me. The president of my university is a relatively devout Christian, right? It gets complicated. I have to go into details. Basically, they haven't touched me. I've had a number of students tell me that they, after my class is over, right, whatever class it is, usually my religion class, students are incredibly in touch with their parents these days, right? They're texting them all the time, they email them all the time, they talk to them all the time. So a lot of my students are actually telling their parents what I'm saying in class, like the same day. And then they'll come back 2 days later and be like, my mom is so mad. My mom hates you, right? Because you're telling her, you know, you're telling me stuff that she can't deny, right? But it certainly runs counter to everything we've been taught. We missed the one I did on demonic possession, right? In my class, I talk about The Exorcist, right? Anybody have seen the movie The Exorcist? Yes. So that's talked about in the book because it's really fascinating. I show that. That's the only non-fiction movie, because it is the only fictional movie. Sorry, I take that back. The only fictional movie I show in my classes. All my others are non-fiction. They're all documentaries. I show The Exorcist in my religion class. Okay? I had one student whose mom was so upset that I was going to show it, she showed up to class that day, just in case one of the students got possessed. Hilarious. I think it's hilarious.
Is that a joke?
Anyway, but usually. Huh?
Are you serious?
Yeah, she showed up. She watched the whole movie. No, I wish I was making a joke. She literally showed up and watched the movie because she was worried watching the movie would potentially possess some of the kids in my class. Yeah, we've got questions for us.
Regarding the presentation of who's more arrogant,
yeah.
I noticed that you didn't make any distinction for religious faiths that are apostolic.
Yeah, do you want to clarify for people what you mean by apostolic?
Well, they have a mission, as did the Mormons.
Sure.
When you send out missionaries, they're out to convert.
Yeah.
Part of their religious faith is a duty or obligation to convince you and save you. And therefore, to some extent, is that truly classifiable as arrogance? Because the point is that the idea is you want to share the benefits you're hoping to get for yourself with others.
And how is that different from evangelical?
The two terms largely overlap, right? Apostolic, it's a mission from the apostles, right? The apostles were told to go share. So it's really not. And it's a good point, right? At the same time, I would say, if you think that you've got the truth, right? Even though, again, you can't know that you have the truth, and you feel so obligated to then go share that truth, isn't that, in a sense, kind of arrogant? And I'm saying that also from personal experience. Remember, I was a missionary. When I went out on my mission, I knew virtually nothing about Mormonism. And I knew even less about all the other religions. Yet I believed I could teach people. That's incredibly arrogant. I mean, honestly, I was an arrogant asshole. And one of my favorite experiences on my mission in Costa Rica, we were knocking on doors. We knocked, there were two of them, but the first one, we knocked on, he was an Anglican pastor. We knocked on his door, and he was very nice. He invited us in, right? And we started talking. It took us 2 minutes to realize this guy had us so outgunned, we didn't have a chance. He knew the Bible way better than we would ever even pretend to know the Bible, right? And I was actually, rather than just be like, you know, I'm leaving, I was like, I could learn from this guy, right? My companion was freaking out. He's like, no, we gotta leave. And I'm like, this guy actually knows what he's talking about, right? I don't, right? Yeah, I've read the Book of Mormon, right? There's all sorts of problems in the Book of Mormon, but he knew the Bible. So it is kind of an arrogant thing to be able to go out and say, we know better than you do. Most of those people, they know nothing about the religions that they're trying to convert. Nothing, right? This is the reality. So it's a good point. Point well taken. I like the point. Yeah, got a comment.
Joseph Campbell, you integrate him into his thoughts into any of your lectures or ideas?
In my sociology religion class, when we're talking about, it's a beautiful term that I think everybody should know about, syncretism, right? It's the idea that religions don't exist in vacuums. They basically steal stuff from other religions, right? And Joseph Campbell very much talks about the kind of the evolution of myth and myth throughout religion. So there are great examples of this, right? Jesus, for instance, he was claimed to have been born of a virgin. Was he the only god in the ancient Middle East who was born of a virgin? No, there were plenty of them. Right? Was he the only god who rose from the dead?
No,
there were plenty of those, right? So when I start talking about syncretism, the idea that religions steal from other religions and incorporate that in, I start talking about Campbell. Yeah. So he gets worked in various ways when I'm talking about myth.
And how a lot of original thought on it.
Yeah, so he's a very insightful.
Is that like synchronicity?
Synchronicity is a little bit different. Synchronicity is combining two. So, syncretism, syncretism, syncretism. It's the idea, I mean, it's a great example, right? Why is, we'll use this one. Does the word Easter show up in the Bible?
No.
Is the word Easter there?
No.
It's kind of an important holiday for Christians, right? Where did the word Easter come from then?
Well,
Yeah, somebody got it. Eostre. She's a Germanic pagan deity, right? And what were the symbols to represent Eostre?
The
lily.
Eggs and bunnies. Eggs and bunnies. What's going on? Hold on. There are no eggs and bunnies in the New Testament. Right? So as Christians started expanding to the barbarians up north and they conquered these people, what did they do? They said, well, you know, you already believe in this. How about we just take some of our ideas, like Jesus died right around then, and then of course he comes back, and that's, you know, this fertility idea, and we'll just kind of overlay that on existing holidays. Right? So we pop, Christmas is the same thing. We pop that right in, and suddenly we've got Easter, which doesn't show up in the New Testament. It's not there, right? And we even adopt the symbols, right? Good luck asking any Christian in the U.S. whether they know the origin of the Easter bunny and Easter eggs. They'll probably tell you it's in the New Testament, and it is not in the New Testament.
Is that a form of usurping?
Yeah, they're just taking it. Right. Another great example, in the U.S., Catholics, right? Catholics are not huge into saint worship in the U.S. Go to Latin America.
Mm-hmm.
It's huge. Why is it so big in Latin America? From the other religions. As Catholic missionaries came in, right, there were already Native Americans here, and they were polytheistic. They had lots of gods. So how do we make it easier for them to convert to Catholicism? Your God is that saint. That God is that saint. And suddenly, we have saint worship.
Same thing in Greek and Italy.
Absolutely. Right? And that term is, it's called syncretism. It's the idea that religions steal from other religions. Right? Religions don't exist in a vacuum. They basically steal their beliefs from other religions. Christianity is syncretistic. I mean, that's all it is. It stole all of its beliefs from existing religions. That's how it came about. Saw another hand somewhere? Yes.
Well, you were talking about polytheism, and the concept of the Trinity would be a polytheistic idea. And it also reflects on the evolution of God, in the sense that you have God of the sky,
right.
God of human Jesus, and then the God of the spirit, which as an evolution of our species, seems to be moving in that direction.
Yes, there's a growth in people who identify as spiritual but not religious, right? That is actually increasing. So more and more people are leaving religions, saying they don't identify with religions, but more people are also saying I'm spiritual but not religious.
So that's what we're experiencing as a
species.
Yeah,
spirit's a
and
weird.
Subtly, people don't realize that.
Yeah, because there's a great book by Elaine Howard Eklund. It's not a great book. It's a problematic book, but she has some interesting findings. She's actually interviewing scientists at elite universities, and many of them are atheists, but many of them also identify as being spiritual. The problem is, when they talk about spiritual, they're not actually talking about the same type of spirituality that most religious people are. They're saying, yeah, sometimes I go out to the ocean, and I look over the ocean, and I'm just like, that's awesome. Or, you know, I'm looking at it through my telescopes, right? Or I'm looking into space, and I'm like, that's amazing. I'm overwhelmed. And I don't know what to call it except a spiritual experience.
Wrong name, but it's...
There's no better term for it. So it's coming to be, when I experience wonder and awe at something...
Well, we should be aware of it.
Yeah. So it's an interesting point. I have another question over here.
Yeah, this is going back a ways, and it's just a matter of curiosity. After your year in college where you decided this is all bunk, what happened with your family?
And my family? Great question. So,
yes.
I was married at the time, still married, actually, same woman. She decided to leave with me. So, I was very devout. I was, you know, the missionary, the whole thing. She was never quite as in. Right? So when I started having my questions and started telling her, hey, look, there are all these problems, she was pretty sympathetic, right? And basically was like, yeah, I'm cool with that. She had her other issues with the religion, too. She's a genetic counselor, which I don't know if you're familiar with that, but
yeah.
As a genetic counselor, when she would counsel patients who had a kid with a deformity, one of the options that she had to give, right, was, well, you can do this, 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 or you can get an abortion. Mormon Church, not in favor of that, right? So she had issues with their positions there. Also, Mormon Church is a patriarchal religion. I mean, there's no question about it, right? It is anti-women.
Right.
So she had issues more on the feminist side, right? Which I have issues there too, but I had other issues that were my big issues. So together we decided to leave at the same time.
summer of 2002. Not all of her family's still in, but at the time they were. Her parents were actually on a mission, which is a little awkward. And all of mine were still in, right? So I didn't know what to expect. We wrote letters to our parents, basically saying, you know, we're not formally leaving the church, we're just not gonna go anymore. It's probably a stupid thing to do, right? We probably should have just stopped going, because we lived in Cincinnati at the time, and all of our family's in Utah. We should probably just like, eh, we're not gonna go anymore, right? But it's weird, right? It's a moral failing that I'm too moral. I had to tell them the truth, right? I just felt obligated to be like, I'm gonna be honest with them. I don't believe this anymore. So we wrote them a letter and said, you know, we love you, family's more important than religion to us, but we need you to know we're just not gonna go to church anymore. We've got issues with the Mormon church, and it's kind of done, right? Her parents were actually pretty cool, though they've said some nasty things since, but I'll tell you one in a minute. But they called her after they got the letter and said, you know, we're disappointed, but we still love you, which is pretty cool, right? My dad never said anything. My mom called me when she got the letter and yelled at me for about 30 minutes, screaming at me how disappointed she was. That I was her greatest disappointment in life, right? That I was the Antichrist, that I was evil, that I knew what I had done was wrong, that I would eventually realize that I had made a huge mistake, and that she, I mean, it's just, it was a really awful situation. And of course, I didn't say anything, right? It was like 30 minutes of her just screaming at me through the phone. And when she was done, I said, well, you know, I'm sorry you feel that way. What else are you gonna say? And she said, that's it? That's all you got to say for yourself? And I'm like, what else do you want me to say? Click. She hung up on me. Right? So that was rough. We're on better terms now. Right? It took about 6 months for her to talk to me again. Right? It was kind of forced. One of my siblings got married, so I went back out, right, to go to the wedding. And I was there. Right? I was there. And my other siblings were talking to me, and eventually, you know, stuff came up, she had to talk to me. Today, we're basically on better terms. It gets a little bit awkward. She doesn't even know I published this book.
Wow.
I'm still my mother's greatest disappointment. A tenured professor, right? With a very happy marriage and a cute little 4-year-old. I'm her greatest disappointment, right? I don't talk to her about religion. Never talk to her about religion, right? I'll talk to her occasionally, and when we talk about specific family things. She knows nothing about my research. She knows that I do research, and I still study Mormonism, which drives her nuts, right? But I just don't talk to her about it. So my family knows nothing about what I study. It's just too challenging, right? So, I don't know, I didn't mean to make this personal. I like the data stuff better, but what does that answer?
I understand. Yeah.
It's probably true for many of you. Other questions, or we can wrap up here?
Well, we're talking about Mormonism. I would just like to know, is Mormonism still growing, or the numbers shrink? More and more educated people becoming less enamored with Mormonism, or?
Great question. How are we doing on time? Sorry,
out,
let's get
straight. We're out of it. But
we're out of time. Okay, we'll wrap up on this question.
I'm
okay?
Afternoon nap. I have to go.
This is your last question. So this is actually an area that I specifically have studied. The Mormon church is really tricky with their numbers. And here's what's going on. They report everybody who's ever joined the church, but unless you formally resign, meaning you have to write their headquarters a letter and say, I want you to take me off the records, they keep you on the records, okay? So what that means, today they're reporting 14 to 15 million Mormons worldwide, okay? But here's the fascinating thing about that. Of those 14 million Mormons, right, they report 1.2 million Mormons in Brazil. But Brazil, on their census, their national census, asks religious identification, okay? Which means we can check. We can say, oh, you say you have 1.2 million Mormons in Brazil. How many people in Brazil self-identify as Mormon? Anybody want to guess what percent or what number? We'll just do raw numbers. What number say they're Mormon in Brazil?
50,000.
It's 200,000. So of the 14 million Mormons that they report, 1 million are Brazilians who were baptized but no longer identify as Mormon. Same situation almost exactly in Mexico. Mexico, they report 1.3 million. and it's about 250,000 who actually identify as Mormon. So when you look at their numbers, they're claiming growth, but they're actually not really growing, hardly at all, right? They're claiming growth because they just don't take anybody off their rolls, right? When I was a Mormon missionary in Costa Rica, one of my techniques, because I hated just knocking on people's doors, is I'd go looking for people who weren't going to church anymore. One of the homes that I knocked on, the kid had been baptized at 8. That's when they do their baptisms, right, at 8. I knocked on the door. The parents said, you know, what are you doing here? And I was like, oh, so-and-so is a member of our religion. And they're like, you sure? I'm like, yeah, he's here. I've got his record, right? He's here. They said, okay, well, we'll go get him. He was mentally retarded. Some missionaries had just baptized him to get a number. That's one more. Kid couldn't read, and he was like 16 at that point. He had no idea what he'd done. How many Mormons around the world are like that?
Don't they baptize the dead?
They do baptize the dead. We are out of time.
Can I give myself a luxury of one last question?
Sure.
Before you do that, I have to go. I have heard many speakers. I have taught public speaking.
Sign the book to Bill and Carol.
And
I have taught and coached executives on public speaking. Never have I heard an opening story like the one you told, and I don't think any opening story will ever catch anyone's attention like the one you told, and I thank you.
I think that will conclude our presentation, but I invite you to stop if you want to ask Ryan any questions or comments. And he's signing a book. I think, you know what, I'll be back there. If anyone wants to buy a book, give me $20. I'll get it out of the bag for you. So thank you for coming.